This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump has repeated his view that a historic meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un set for June 12 in Singapore may not take place.
See what happens, whether or not it happens. If it does, that'll be great. It'll be a great thing for North Korea. And if it doesn't, that's okay, too. Whatever it is, it is.
Mr. Trump said preparations continue in setting the conditions for the meeting. If it does take place, he said, it could turn out to be a great session for North Korea and the world.
For a short period of time, we've been dealing with North Korea, and it's been a, good experience. We have three hostages back. They're home. They're living with their families. They're very, very happy. And so I can only speak for a very short period of time, but it's been a relationship that seems to be working, and we'll see how long it continues to work.
The president met Tuesday with his South Korean counterpart, Moon Jae-in, at the White House. Mr. Moon spoke through an interpreter.
Thanks to your vision of achieving peace through strength, as well as your strong leadership, we are looking forward to the first ever U.S.-North Korea summit, and we find ourselves standing one step closer to the dream of achieving complete denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula and world peace.
North Korea last week indicated it might call off the meeting over U.S.-South Korea military drills and demands it unilaterally denuclearize. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Ebola death toll now stands at 27, with two new fatalities reported from the deadly virus, one of them in the northwest city of Mbandaka, a city of 1 million. The health ministry also announced six more confirmed cases and two suspected cases, even as an experimental vaccine is being used to fight the deadly disease. This is VOA News. President Trump Tuesday said there's no deal yet to lift the seven-year ban on the sale of American-made components to the Chinese giant telecom ZTE, but that there might be a settlement as part of ongoing trade talks between the world's top two economies.
I envision a very large fine. I envision perhaps new management, new board of directors, very tight security rules. But we caught them doing bad things. We caught them, not anybody else. We caught them doing bad things. And we essentially made it so difficult that it was shut down. By shutting them down, we're hurting a lot of American companies.
ZTE was sanctioned for violating the U.S. ban on trade with Iran and North Korea. Venezuela Tuesday ordered the expulsion of two top U.S. diplomats following the imposition of new sanctions aimed at choking off financing to the government of President Nicolas Maduro. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert had little to say about the diplomatic incident.
What I can say, we completely reject the false allegations that have been made by the Maduro regime against our two colleagues, and I have nothing further beyond that.
She did condemn what she called Sunday's sham election, in which Mr. Maduro won his second term with 67% of the vote, despite a sharp decline in voter participation. The U.S. increased its pressure on the Iranian regime Tuesday, blacklisting five Iranians who allegedly supply missile technology to Houthi rebels in Yemen. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who Monday warned Tehran it faces the strongest sanctions in history, spoke about the matter again Tuesday.
We asked them to stop firing missiles into Riyadh. This is not a fantasy to imagine the Iranians making a decision not to fire missiles into another nation and threatening American lives that travel through that airport. It's not a fantasy to ask them to cease engaging in terror. These were all a set of demands, the demands we put on the rest of the world.
Pompeo called them a simple set of requirements that, if met, would benefit the Iranian people. In India's Tamil Nadu state, at least nine were killed Tuesday when police opened fire on protesters demanding the closure of a copper smelter, which they allege causes pollution and harms local fisheries. Police responded after some of the demonstrators turned violent. The rights group Amnesty International Tuesday said it has evidence armed Rohingya Muslims killed scores of Hindu civilians last August. It said nearly 100 Hindus were killed by members of the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, part of the violence that targeted a security force crackdown in Myanmar. Israeli warplanes destroyed a boat moored in Gaza City early Wednesday. The military said the strike was aimed at military targets of Hamas. No casualties reported. It followed a security breach of the Israeli border fence on Tuesday, resulting in a fire at an army base. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Angola fires two of its diplomats relating to last week's U.S. embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
It wasn't the ambassador. It was Mr. Espirito Santo, which is, in fact, the director for Middle East and Africa Affairs at the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai. Burundi's government maintains its security grip 3 years after the 2015 political unrest. We will take another look at Sierra Leone's ban on pregnant girls attending school, and South Sudan parties continue their consultations in Addis Ababa with no agreement yet.
South Sudan Council of Churches urges the parties to cooperate with one another in the spirit of compromise and for the sake of the millions of suffering South Sudanese.
Justin Badi is the Anglican Archbishop of South Sudan. Malawi declares itself cholera-free 6 months after an outbreak killed 30 people. And Uganda seeks safer motorcycle taxis, known locally as Boda Boda. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Angola has fired two of its diplomats relating to last week's move of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. According to Angolan state-run media, Foreign Minister Manuel Augusto dismissed João Diogo Fortunato for participating in the ceremony marking the relocation of the U.S. embassy. Augusto also fired Joaquim do Espírito Santo, director for Africa and Middle East in the Angolan Foreign Ministry, for authorizing Fortunato's attendance at the May 13th party in Jerusalem. In another development, Angolan journalist Rafael Marques de Morales, who braved decades of harassment and prosecution to expose corruption and human rights abuses in Angola, has been named the International Press Institute's 70th World Press Freedom Euro. But first, veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai says the diplomats were fired for what the foreign ministry calls doing harm to Angola's good reputation.
In reality, James, the one which was fired, it wasn't the ambassador. It was Mr. Espirito Santo, which is, in fact, the director for Middle East and Africa Affairs at the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So he's a top-ranking official. And the thing out of that, it was that he allowed someone from the Angolan embassy in Israel to attend the inauguration of the USA embassy in Jerusalem. I must also to underline that this Wednesday, there will be a major meeting of all Angolan ambassadors outside. And Mr. João Lourenço, the Angolan president, is expected to make a major speech outlining the strong lines of the Angolan diplomacy vis-a-vis the war.
So, Mario, what has been the relationship between Israel and Angola?
That's the key point. In fact, Angola has some kind of stronger relationship with Israel, especially with the military security, also in some way in agriculture and other fields. But we must remind that Israel, intelligence and security Israeli forces, has played a major role in the last days of the fight of the Angolan government forces against the Savimbi UNITA forces. After that, the relationship between Israel and Angola has improved in some kinds of, with agricultures and other sides. But in political terms, a lot of the establishment doesn't like these kind of relations. So after the end of the war.
Mario, I know you know about journalist Rafael Marques de Morales of Angola. The news coming out on Tuesday was that the International Press Institute has named him the Press Freedom Hero. You know his story. First of all, let me get your reaction to this award.
Yes, of course. First, I must congratulate Rafael himself. We have been fighting for press freedoms a long time ago, several years. Right now, he's on trial again with the former High Court General. So Rafael is not someone who just appeared in the last year. So he's going year after year, taking his stance on press freedoms, especially against corruption. They've got the site, Macangola. So there is some kind of happiness amongst Angolan journalists, because in one way or another, this means some kind of recognition of the fight for press freedoms for Angolan journalists. I talked with Rafael 1 hour ago, and he say everything is okay, and we will follow to support and to fight for press freedom.
Where is he now?
He is supposed to go to Canada, but Canada blocked his visa, but now this question, it seems to be over now.
Okay, Mario, thank you very much again. It's always a pleasure to have you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much, James.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai speaking with us from the Angolan capital, Luanda. South Sudan's warring parties meeting in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, have yet to sign a peace deal following 5 days of intense negotiations, prompting the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD, negotiators to draft a proposal addressing many of the sticking points. As YK Simon Wudu reports from Addis Ababa, the parties are expected to sign the document.
The primary warring parties, activists and observers have assigned a document which recommits them to continue to talk about governance issues, including implementing 35% affirmative action for women at all levels of government, acknowledging the need for all guns to fall silent and respecting the cessation of hostilities agreement signed last December. Church leaders have been leading this round of talks. Justin Badi, the Archbishop of the Anglican Church of South Sudan, emerged from meetings today to relay this simple message.
South Sudan Council of Churches urges the parties to cooperate with one another in the spirit of compromise and with IGAD for the sake of the millions of suffering South Sudanese.
Mabior Garang chairs the communication committee of the SPLM in opposition.
The little progress that we have made, I think we can be hopeful.
The failure of the parties to reach a deal after several months of negotiations is seen as a major disappointment by many South Sudanese and other observers. Clement Janda, a representative of South Sudanese refugees from Uganda at the talks, says the warring parties refuse to put the people first.
The issue of those of us suffering in the refugee camps and those, I believe, in the IDP camps were never an issue in this forum. People are talking about dividing positions, presidency, vice presidency, and you name it. But they're not talking about the suffering of the millions in the IDP camps and in the refugee camps.
Besides a lack of trust, John Pendengong, a civil society activist delegate at the talks, says the lack of pressure from regional and international observers is one reason the parties failed to sign a deal. He also says there are too many delegates at the talks.
Parties are too many, and if there are too many, the consensus will take long to reach. So if we could concretize and make the parties who are fighting talk face to face.
Penn also thinks the principal of the warring parties, President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar, need to take part so they can tackle some of the hardest issues to resolve. After the parties failed to compromise and reach a deal on key issues, IGAD leaders presented to the warring parties' delegates a drafty proposal on security and other issues the parties are expected to sign. The new deal proposes one president and three vice presidents. It has also proposed 42 ministers and 15 deputy ministers. Under the deal, the position of president is designated to the transitional government of national unity, first vice president would be designated to the SPLMIO, led by Riek Machar, and vice president and the third vice president would be designated to the transitional government and other political entities. The power-sharing ratios in the national government would be 55% for the transitional government, 25% for the SPLMIO Machar faction, and 20% for other political entities. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wodo in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Today's Wednesday, May 23rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. The shadow cast by the Burundian government's crackdown on the 2015 political unrest lingers over the capital as tightened security measures continue to be observed. Residents must keep lockbooks in their homes where they know down anyone who visits. Government security services can demand to see the logs, and failure to produce them can result in arrest. Mohamed Yusuf reports for VOA from Bujumbura.
...22-year-old Irakuze lives in one of the neighborhoods where protests erupted in 2015. She has not fled her area, but she has spent much of her time alone. She says it is 2 years since the government gave her the book, and she has not received any visitor because people are afraid. The Burundian authorities distributed notebooks in homes so people can register their family members and those who visit them. People are required to report any visitor to the government's area chief. Failure to report and register a visitor can be a ticket to jail. Police enforce the regulations with frequent searches, something that terrifies Irakoze. She explains, police knock the door by force, scare her family, wake up her children from their sleep. And the sound of the knock can have an impact even on those who are sick. She says sometimes you think you are being attacked by criminals. They come with a lot of force to do their search. Security agencies believe keeping record of people's movements will help them maintain peace and security. Some people support the policy. 68-year-old Duabike Michel says the logbook keep him safe. He says it is good to have the book because no one bothers you. He says there is no fine if you keep the record of the visitors at home, and it is good to live freely without fear. A man who lives in Chibitoke neighborhood, an area that has protested against President Pierre Nkurunziza's rule, told VOA the police search is not about improving security, but to punish people for their political views. He says it's not bad to do searches, but they do a lot of searches in areas where people protested against the government. But in the areas where there were no protests, they do not do searches. He adds, it does not mean that all bad people come from the area. The whole search issue has a political agenda. The 2015 unrest was sparked by the president's decision to run for a controversial third term. Last week, Burundians approved a new constitution that will allow Nkurunziza to potentially stay in office until 2034. The United States said the process was marred by a lack of transparency and efforts to intimidate the opponents. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Bujumbura.
Efforts to reverse Sierra Leone's ban on pregnant girls attending school scored a win last week when the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS Community Court, agreed to examine the law's validity. Amnesty International welcomed the move, saying the right of pregnant girls to education is an important issue across Africa. Abdul Kamukai, Executive Director of the Defense for Children International in Sierra Leone, spoke to Reki Shryak about how the law increases dropout rates among young girls and the need to change it.
If you take this many girls who are getting pregnant out of school, you are just increasing the number of dropouts. Most of the time, when you stop these pregnant girls from attending school and there is a break in their educational program, when they give birth, it is always difficult for them to return to school because some of them would even be ashamed of the fact that their colleagues are now ahead of them. Even that 1 year, it's something that is not easy to catch up with.
And what does it mean that the Economic Community of West African States, their Court of Justice, is going to look at this? You know, what kind of hope does that give you as an activist in Sierra Leone?
We think it will bring something positive. This is our hope, and this is the reason why we went here. First of all, Sierra Leone is a state party to ECOWAS and have signed so many ECOWAS protocols that actually enforce the need for people as well as women and girls to have access to education. Now, setting up an ECOWAS court is a mechanism to actually address justice. People can go there and get remedy. So we are going to this court not to shame the government, not to embarrass the government, but we want ECOWAS to force the government to reverse this policy. So going to ECOWAS court is just to reemphasize the fact that these girls have the right to be in school, and also in addition to the fact that our government has ratified international and regional treaties.
How many girls are affected by this law at the current time? Do you know how many girls are kept out of school approximately in Sierra Leone every year?
Well, we don't have an updated figure, but there are some statistics floating around which really shows a high rate of teenage pregnancy. For example, there's the UNFPA statistics which shows that one out of every three girls in Sierra Leone pregnant before age 18. And there's also in 2015-16, after Ebola, it was estimated that over 500 girls got pregnant. And the situation and the conditions that make these girls pregnant have not really changed. So you notice that even if there's any change in trend, it should be minimal. So you can see in fact that many girls are still getting pregnant and dropping out of school.
Abdul Kemokai is the executive director of the Defense for Children International in Sierra Leone. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the capital, Freetown. Malawi has declared itself cholera-free 6 months after an outbreak killed 30 people and affected nearly 1,000 others. Officials are crediting a health education campaign and a push to make clean water available in the worst-hit areas and convince people to wash their hands with soap. However, health commentators say cholera is likely to return unless the country implements measures to prevent another outbreak. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's first recorded cholera case came soon after the start of rainy season last November. The disease, which causes severe diarrhea and can be deadly within hours if not treated, has killed 30 people and affected 929 others in 10 of the country's 28 districts. West Hit districts were Karonga, Salima, and the capital, Lilongwe. Now the country has recorded no case of cholera since April 28. Minister of Health authorities say this means Malawi has earned a World Health Organization cholera-free status for going 21 days without recording a new case. Joshua Malango is the spokesperson for the Minister of Health. He says the achievement is a result of collaborative effort to fight the disease that spreads via contaminated food and water.
We had to use the awareness campaign to the community in issue to do with cholera. But also, we have to acknowledge the support which we had from our developing partners, but also some of the stakeholders which we were with at the minister level, community leaders, but also religious leaders.
He says part of the intervention was a nationwide campaign which aimed to remind people to wash their hands with soap, especially after using the toilet and before eating any food. Health authorities have also been distributing chlorine and other chemicals to treat drinking water. UN's children agency, UNICEF, was among the development partners who helped to fight the outbreak. For example, in February, it used drones to map out cholera hotspots in the capital, Lilongwe. A month later, it distributed safe water to needy communities. Johannes Videnik is UNICEF representative in Malawi.
We are very delighted about the fact that we have now 3 weeks without any new cholera cases. And obviously it showed that by pulling together, we were able to basically reduce the spread of the outbreak, particularly in Lilongwe, which is obviously a high-density area.
However, he says some underlying issues must be addressed or the outbreak is likely to return soon or later.
We have seen in our field visits that there are many unsafe sources of water, be they open wells, be they rivers. And the next one is obviously unsafe hygiene and sanitation practices, which also fuel the spread of cholera.
Health spokesperson Malango says government will continue with its health education campaign and other efforts that have helped stop the outbreak. Malango also says the ministry has started administering oral cholera vaccine targeting over 500,000 residents in cholera-prone areas of the capital, Lilongwe. World Health Organization says on its website that the vaccine has also been administered in Zambia, Uganda, South Sudan, and Nigeria, and its distribution is expected to end by mid-June. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
In Uganda, motorcycle taxis, known locally as boda bodas, provide a quick and cheap way to get around. But the drivers can be notoriously reckless, contributing to road accidents and injuries. A local software developer and a former boda boda driver joined forces, helping to transform the market with their Safe Boda app. From Kampala, Halima Athumani reports for VOA on what is being called Uganda's Uber for motorcycle taxis.
With endless traffic in Kampala, boda bodas are often the best option for quickly getting where you need to go. But Ugandan police say crashes from the popular and unregulated mode of transport have killed at least 7,000 people in the last 3 years. The Mlago National Referral Hospital gets about 8 patients a day who are victims of boda boda wrecks.
80% and above sometimes are trauma. 90% of these are boda-boda accidents. We actually fail to operate patients with brain tumors because of the overwhelming head injury patients we get.
Former boda-boda driver Ricky Rapper-Thompson wants to improve motorcycle safety. He co-developed the Safe Boda mobile application.
The problem is you don't know who to ride with, and you don't know who is the right driver, and you don't know who is trained, and you don't know who is fit to be on the road.
Riders can hail a ride using the app. Safe Boda screens its drivers and gives them road safety training. They must obey traffic lights and pay attention to pedestrians. They also provide passengers with a clean hairnet and helmet, a rare safety measure in Kampala.
Since I joined Safe Boda, a lot has changed, because now I've become even more patient than I was before on the road. I even give way to both cyclists, even motor vehicles, allow them go, because I know the most important is to reach the destination safely.
Despite offering safer and cheaper service, the application has struggled to attract users in the 4 years since it was developed. Ugandans without smartphones do not have the option, while others prefer to haggle for their rides in person. Halima Afmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Zimbabwe's Parliamentary Committee on Mines is expected today, Wednesday, to press former President Robert Mugabe to give evidence about the disappearance of diamond revenues amounting to $15 billion during Mr. Mugabe's rule. The Mines Committee, led by independent legislator Temba Mliswa, said it will conduct the hearing at Mr. Mugabe's Harare mansion. The move follows previous failed attempts to summon the former president to parliament to discuss the missing diamond revenues. Neither Mr. Mugabe nor presidential spokesman George Charamba were available for comment. South Sudan's warring parties meeting in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa have yet to sign a peace deal following 5 days of intense negotiations. That's it for this Wednesday, May 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Douglas Mpuga, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpuga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.